Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso. Glenn Elms was a Brisbane boy who represented the state seat of Noosa as a Liberal MP. Radio was his first love, scoring a job at 4IP Brisbane halfway through radio school, followed by radio stints at Mount Isa, Warwick and Gympie before playing politics. In this podcast, we talk about political careers and how they can only ever end in a brutal fashion. We talk about Glenn's early radio days and why sustainable growth in Noosa is good for everyone.
Well, I was a career politician for 11 and a quarter years. I like to put the quarter on. So I was elected in September of 2006, and the election was in November of last year, 2017.
You were a radio guy, and we'll get into that shortly, but what made you want to get into politics?
Well, my radio career and my interest in politics almost sort of went hand in hand. I joined what was the old Liberal Party in Mount Isa when I was, I think, 18 or 17 or something. And I was at 411 Mount Isa in those days. So it was always something that really interested me. I had a grandfather. My grandfather was a Wharfie, which will give you some idea of his politics. And I spent a lot of time with him, and I saw the way people would go to him. He wasn't an elected member, but he used to go up to City Hall and talk to aldermen as they were in those days and help people out and all the rest of it. It was something that really interested me. So I've been in what's now the LNP nearly 45 years. So, it's been part of my life for as long as I can remember.
You mentioned that your granddad was a Wharfie, so I imagine he would have been a Labor supporter.
Labor to the core.
Okay, so what made you decide? But being out on the land, your parents would have been National Party or Conservatives.
No, I'm a Brisbane boy.
Right.
But I have family on the land. I was, in Mount Isa, I was deciding, well, do I join the Country Party.
And how did you decide?
Well, I came from Brisbane. I was a city boy.
Yeah.
And it was the right decision. I learnt through all of my time in country Queensland, which I just love. But you can't take the city out of the boy any more than you can take the country out. You understand it. You can talk to people about it. You can sympathise with people and all the rest of it, but it's not in your core. You weren't born into it. And at the end of the day, I'm a city boy, and that's the way it's been.
So let's talk about moving from – you talked about 4LM – When you left school, we talked before we switched the mics on. You started working at the age of 15, like I did too. Saturday mornings and Thursday nights at Coles supermarket. Was it radio? Was that your first passion, Glenn?
No. Oh well, I worked at a shipping company first called France Australia, which was bought out by James Patrick, Patrick Stevedores, those sorts of people. And I can remember going to Patrick's and they were down in the old Maritime building, which was right next to the Customs House in Brisbane, long gone now. And I went in on that first day after France Australia had sort of merged, and there was these long series of desks, one behind the other, behind the other, behind the other. And the way you progressed at Patrick's was to wait for someone to die or to retire.
And you could move up those lines.
And you moved back a desk until eventually you got to the desk at the back and you could supervise all the desks at the front.
I see. That's how
And I thought to myself, there'd been people there 40 years. And I thought, I couldn't do this. So for some reason, there was a course called Air TV.
Same one I did.
Did you? There you go.
1989.
Yeah, well, I was a bit earlier than that, but Ivor Hancock and Jim Iliffe ran it in those days, and it was a 40-week course, and so I started to do that. And there was a job advertised about halfway through, a job advertised for an office boy at 4IP in Brisbane. And 4IP in those days was the station.
Yeah, it was the king of radio.
Absolutely. And so I applied for it, became the office boy at 4IP. And Alan Brandt, who was the manager of the station, said, look, we want to train you our way. And, the good thing about Ivor Hancock and Jim Iliffe, I went and talked to them. They were happy to see me go. They refunded half the money from the course. That was the sort of people that were around in those days.
Yeah.
And I started at 4IP. Now, everyone at 4IP had a title. So I very quickly went from being the office boy to the director of telecommunications and postal services, which is code for being the office boy. But, you know, I enjoyed the title.
It was a great title. Was your desire then to get on air? Mm.
Is that what you wanted to? Yeah,
very much so.
Right. I would get to work, I think, about 7:30 in the morning, and there were three of us, a bloke by the name of Michael Bailey, who's a dear friend of mine still today, he's on 4CC in Gladstone, and Greg Lawson, who was Cousin Greg in the Breakfast Club, and myself, and we'd go into Alan Brandt's office, and he'd hand you a book or a newspaper or something like that, you say, and Alan Brandt was a big, loud man, struck terror into people. So read, and you know, and if you missed a comma or you stumbled over a word, you know, you're into it. Anyway, so I would do that, finish there, I'd go off and do my office boying duties around the place, and then at 5 o'clock I'd head into one of the studios and I'd put down what we, you know, an air check. So I'd put a little program together and all the rest of it. So this is where you sort of got to skip forward a bit. So there was a bloke by the name of Frank Moore, who's still around, a great mentor of mine, who was one of the owners of the network. And he would appear out of the lift the next morning and I'd be waiting for him. We always called him FT. FT, FT, I've got another thing for you. You know. Yeah. So I'd... Poor man, I'd drag him just about. I don't know how he put up with me. Dragged him into the studio to listen to how I read the news and how I read a piece of live copy and how I introduced, it was all 45s in those days, how you introduced a record. And he'd say, oh, Glenn, you're doing really well. You know, just, you know, keep up the good work. And after about 6 months, he called me in and said, I better see your father. So I got Dad to come in and they went and had a bit of a huddle for half an hour or so. I got called in and he said, you start in Mount Isa on Monday, and I think this is a Thursday.
Okay.
So there I was.
So 4LM was part of that network.
Yeah, the old colour radio network. Yeah.
And were you prepared to go out there? Because I know as a, you know, it's difficult for people born and bred in a city like Brisbane to go, oh, really? I've got to go, to Mount Isa.
Well, I'd never been away from home before.
I know. That's the other part of
and,
it too.
to go from Brisbane to Mount Isa, there's not too many places in Queensland you can go further than go from Brisbane to Mount Isa. So I had three conditions when I went to the ISA. I had to board with a family. I had to go to church on a Sunday. And the manager of the station had to hold my bank book.
Now, whose conditions were they, though?
They were Frank Moore's.
No, they were his conditions.
Yeah, they were his conditions. So I never went to church. I did board with a family, but that's another long, funny story. When I handed my bank book to the manager, he sort of looked at me and handed it straight back. But I was the junior announcer and started up there just before Christmas.
And how long did you stay at 4LM?
Oh, I was there about 15 months.
Yeah.
And then another station in the network was 4WK in Warwick, which is now sort of Warwick Toowoomba. But in those days it was in Warwick. So I got transferred to 4WK. And I started then to make the sort of transition from being on air into sales, which I really liked.
Why'd you do that? Because I think... There are two very clear paths in radio. You either have that desire to be behind a microphone or the desire to kind of make some coin and do sales. Was that your...
Well, I used to keep a phone very close to me in Mount Isa, and strangely, the 2UWs and 2UEs of the 2SMs of the world never rang. I don't know why.
But were you trying, Glenn? Because that
maybe I should have tried.
No, but it sounded like you were one of the, because I had to do the same thing, you know, waiting by the elevator door for the boss of the network to come through. That was what you had to do.
You had
to hassle them. Were you hassling the 2UEs?
I can remember sending a couple of air checks off and that sort of thing. I remember sending one to 4GG on the Gold Coast. Everyone wanted to work at 4GG. But, you know, I mean, I knew I loved it. I'd probably love radio, doing the on-air work in radio now, more than what I did back then, particularly a talk thing like you and I are doing. But I also realised, look, you know, John Laws is not about to retire to allow me to take his spot. You know, what else is there around the place that I really enjoy doing? Yeah. And, you know, I love selling.
Do you?
Again, it was that interaction with
I think you've got to have it, though, to be a...
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't have it.
Yeah, well, I slowly sort of transitioned out of the on-air work at 4WK in Warwick to doing sort of part on-air, part sales. Then I became the sales manager for the Southern Downs. Then they took me up to Toowoomba because the station had moved and became the sales manager for the, you know, for the radio station for 4WK.
Yeah. I first heard of you, Glenn, I think at 4GY. So you were the general manager at 4GY?
Yes, yeah.
What period of time and who owned it at that stage?
Well, I went there in 89. So I'd been in Emerald. We were talking about 4HI before, so I'd kicked that off in 81. Left there in 85 down to the coast. But I went to GY, I think, in 89.
Wesgo?
No, it was Bill Corrales.
Oh, he owned it back then.
Yeah.
Still does.
He'd just bought it
right. And
still owns it.
Yeah.
And I stayed there until I went into politics in 2006.
And what was the catalyst for that?
I wanted a shot at politics.
Yeah.
And in politics, you have to take your chances when they come around. A lot of people want to be in the Senate so that they can sit there and pontificate and make themselves look important or into the federal parliament or the state or whatever. But you've got to, when the opportunity comes, you've got to seize it because it may not come around again. So in my case, it was the state seat that came around. So I actually stood in 2004. We'd lost the seat. The Liberal Party had lost the seat. So I stood the next election.
Who won that seat in 2004?
Well, it was Bruce Davidson, who was the Liberal member prior to that.
That seat still the seat of Noosa, though?
Yes, it had just become Noosa.
Right.
It had just become
Noosa. Okay.
And a lady by the name of Kate Molloy for the Labor Party won the seat. So in 2004, I stood, and it was a very tight margin. It was only sort of a 1% or something like that. So I stood and I put everything into it, and we went back by about 5%. So not only did I lose, I went back 5.
Right.
So I had to do all the machinations again and all the rest of it to get myself in a position to be able to be the candidate again in 2006. And we sort of pegged that back and won the seat, and I held it since.
You've got to take a few kicks in politics, and it's the kind of, again, we're talking about long games. It's the kind of game where you've got to give it not just one or two, but a few goes. So what kept you motivated to go, no, this is what I want to do, this is what I believe in, and I'm going to give it another shot?
Well, it's high risk. When I lost the election in 2004, I went home with my wife and we had a bit of a talk about it on the Saturday night after the election was over. And I said, well, look, is that it? I'd been in the party since I was 18. I'd loved it. I did a lot of work in the Liberal Party organisation. I was on the state executive and all sorts of things. It was my passion. So is that it? Do you leave it at that point? Walk away and say, well, that was, you know, close that part of your life. And I couldn't. So that next Monday, I was back going to the community meetings and all the rest of it that I was at the week before. So I really campaigned for, you know, 18 months prior to the 84 election. And for the 3 years, or the 2 years, whatever it was, between 2004 and 2006, I never stopped. So it was something that it's like everyone has goals. You achieve goals by absolutely, totally believing in them, thinking about them all the time, dreaming about them all the time, picturing yourself doing them all the time.
Yeah.
Now, if you do all of that, chances are you're going to achieve your goal.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And I was, you know, I was pretty
sounds like you and I read the same books too. Did you read a lot of Zig Ziglar?
Yeah, well, there's a Psycho-Cybernetics.
I think I've got that up there.
Oh, I have you. I'd love to read it again. I need a refresher.
Well, that must have been that. Maybe we got that title from Air TV. Maybe it was one of those
Maxwell, Jim Iliffe. Is it Maxwell Maltz?
No, I do have it. And Napoleon Hill and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Now, so 11 years as the state member for Noosa. Mm. Out of those 11 years, how long, how many of those 11 years did the Liberals form government?
We were only there for two and three quarter years.
Was that the Campbell Newman?
That was the Campbell Newman. So I was a minister in the Newman years, held all sorts of shadow ministerial roles, around that. It was disappointing in the sense that we didn't have longer in government. It was also disappointing in the sense that when we came into government, we believed, and I still do believe, because it's not fixed, that the state debt was so bad that we needed to put the brakes on it. So in government, you think normally I can do all these things and deliver this for the community and that. But what we were focused on was bringing the debt under control. So we tightened the purse strings. So, all of the electorates that we represented as a government got less. They didn't get more because we were trying to bring it under control.
Prior to Campbell Newman coming in as the leader, running and winning that term, it appeared from the outside. You're on the inside. Are you involved at all with the Liberal Party these days?
Oh, absolutely.
I wanted you to talk openly about it. Would appear that there were some pretty dark days for the Liberal Party. There seemed to be like a revolving door in terms of leadership from Springborg to, I remember the name Quinn in there as well.
Yeah, well, Quinny was long before, wasn't it? But you had John Paul Langbrook,
who's a dear
friend of mine.
Yes.
Who was the leader. I was with John Paul when he was just before he walked out to resign because of the Campbell Newman coming into the
But can you what was it like within the party? Because it just appeared like they couldn't get a handle on who was going to lead this party and who could lead them to an election win.
And that's why there were two parties. There was the Nats and the Libs. So the push came on because we used to fight about what seats we would run in, then sometimes we'd both run in the same seat. So the resources of the two parties were being used against each other rather than the real enemy, which was the political enemy, which was the Labor Party. So we eventually got the merger done, and that's now 10 years ago this year. So that settled it down. We had Lawrence Springborg as the initial leader. Took us to an election. I think we lost. Then John Paul and then Campbell Newman came in and we won that election.
Now, you didn't lose your seat when Campbell was ousted. You hung on to that seat for another term. What was the feeling within the party at that point?
We knew we were going to lose seats because the number of seats that we won when Campbell became the Premier was extraordinary. Labor were reduced to 7 seats. We won seats that no Conservative had ever won before. Part of that was the seeds of our own destruction, in a way, because you have people in very safe Labor seats. So you have to put someone up. You're never going to win the seat because they're so strongly Labor. So you have someone who effectively goes in there to fly the flag on behalf of the party. Well, those people are getting elected at that election. And they came into the Parliament then full of their own self-importance I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And some of these people that were under normal circumstances would never have been elected caused us all sorts of troubles internally, not all, but some. And that was something that we had to try and work our way through.
Were you confident that you would keep your seat?
I'd done research and polling and so forth. I knew I was going to take a hit, and we all did. I think I lost something like 16% of my margin. I'd built the margin up well into the 60s. So I knew I was going to take a hit. As I said, we all did. And after that election, Lawrence Springboard came back in virtually as a sort of stopgap leader. And I said to Lawrence, I said, look, the town I live in, the community I live in is changing, and it still continues to change. I need to be able to go back and be the local member again and spend my time there because they were going to give me tourism, which would have been a nice gig as a shadow minister. But I decided that I needed to spend some time, more time here because as a minister, you're just never home. I was getting home maybe one night in a fortnight. So you'd sort of say hello to your wife and race off to a community meeting somewhere, and the next morning the car was there to take you back to Brisbane. That was just the way it was.
So what happened, Glenn, with the last state election against Sandy Bolton?
Well, there was, I think, there was certainly an it's time factor involved. But other than that, there was a bit of a perfect storm. The Labor Party one night, very late at night, reintroduced preferential voting. So that was a factor. So people have to push, you know, apply their preferences throughout. When the candidate draw came about, when the nominations closed, Sandy Bolton drew the number one position. There were seven candidates, me included. Six directed their preferences against me to her. So I had to do...
She had a high profile.
Yeah, I had to do enormously well on primary votes. And it was, and I look, I knew as soon as the candidate draw was done that I was done.
Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't stop you from trying.
Was it a tight... What was the number of votes? Was it close?
In terms of the primary votes, yeah. It was very close.
Right.
But when you apply the preferences, it makes it a standout win.
Do you miss public life?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I always wanted one more term. That was going to be this term was going to be the end of it. It's a hard thing to come to grips with. You go to work on a Saturday morning on election day, and by 8 o'clock that night you don't have a job.
Can you talk about that? Like that whether that's emotional, the kind of support you require from your family, but how does it feel?
Oh, it's gut wrenching.
Yeah. So you knew on Saturday night it was.
Oh yeah, well you knew. Yep, you know, yep. You see the votes coming in, you know you're done.
Yeah.
I tried to prepare myself because I knew I was in lots of trouble. You have all the plans down what you're going to be doing that next Monday. Well, yes, Monday comes and you're in the office, but it's packing up to get out of the office as quickly as you possibly can. It's a ruthless exit. It was the same when we lost government and, you know, you cease being a minister.
There's never been a pleasant exit, though, in politics, has there?
No, there's never been.
And it's always got to be ruthless. Yeah.
It's always ruthless.
It has to
but
be.
It's even the systems involved in getting you out are ruthless.
Yeah.
You know, it's the old story about being a rooster one day and a feather duster the next. Well, that's... Couldn't be
true.
Is that
an old Joe comment? Who was that?
Yeah, that was probably an old Joeism. It probably was.
It was. That is tough. You're right, just thinking about it, and it's probably I've heard it somewhere else, but there is no easy exit or pleasant exit out of politics or public life, is there?
Look, public life is probably, to me, the most rewarding thing you can do. It has extreme highs, has extreme low. Well, I just talked about the low. The high was being a minister and those sorts of things. But there's not a lot in between. If you make a mistake, the whole world knows. And they write the letters in the editor and you get those fools on Facebook, that the trolls that have a go at you.
I just wanted to talk to you because you would have been, were you tight with David Gibson in Gympie?
Oh, yeah. We were candidates at the same time when the Traveston Crossing Dam was being proposed.
Because his, I guess, rise and fall... And we're just talking about this media cycle now with social media as well when he was – and you might have to just clarify a couple of points because I'm only recalling now from memory. He was made police minister one day and it kind of – was it
48? 2 weeks later he wasn't there.
It was 2 weeks later. It was all over.
Yeah.
Was the impact – and again, this what you're talking about, this new cycle, this fast-moving, if you can make a mistake, there are severe consequences now in public life. Did that have an impact on you? Do you think about that much? Did that worry you? Were you concerned about your footing in terms of how to navigate that landscape?
Well, look, it was a warning. But the other thing is, and anyone who's listening to us now that might be thinking about going into a political career...
What would your advice be?
If you've got a skeleton in your closet, don't. Because one day, regardless of how much you may want to cover it up or sweep it under the carpet, it will come out. If you don't have a skeleton in your closet and you get into public life, be scrupulously... honest in the way you deal with things like office expenses and the way you go about your job and all the rest of it. Because if you don't, one day it will come out. Nothing truer.
I don't know if you've watched House of Cards with Kevin.
Oh, absolutely. You know, perfect. I've only
watched the first season.
Yeah.
That Congressman Russo.
Yes.
What about his tactic of coming clean? As he's running for governor of whatever state it is, and saying, "Well, you know, I've had addiction, I've had all," but I mean, that it didn't end well for him.
No, it didn't. It never does.
That's not going to work either. Honest, being completely transparent.
Yeah, I mean, if you've done something that's dishonest or not morally ethical or whatever, it's all very well getting a headline in a paper, but you've got to walk down the street. You've got to walk into Woolies and do your shopping, and you're on public display there on the spot, a live, kicking, breathing human being.
Would people hassle you a lot when you were a member for Noosa? Just any little thing. They say, there's Glenn. I've got to talk to him about.
And that's why I did the Woolies thing. We used to make a point of going to a different supermarket. If I was home, we'd go to a different supermarket on a weekend to do the shopping. So I'd be in Taunton one day or down to the IGA at Perigee the next and Coles in the junction the one after that.
So you're inviting people up to
absolutely.
Come
you
and
do.
Talk to you.
It's important.
Yeah.
I still go do the shopping. I can be gone away, and you know, I can be away for a couple of hours because you get pulled up in an aisle and someone's commiserating with you because you lost the election, or Glenn, how are you going, and all that sort of stuff, and you're talking to people, and that's the way it is. That's what you're supposed to do in public life. You speak to people, you get their views, understand where they're coming from, helps you in the decisions that you've got to make.
What are you most proud of looking back on those 11 years?
Well, there's a few things. One of the smaller areas of my ministerial responsibility was that I had I was responsible for the ANZAC 100 celebrations. So we had $54 odd million that we were putting into grants and that sort of thing. But I worked with the Brisbane City Council and the committee that I formed in the refurbishment of ANZAC Square in Brisbane. So, because it was in a bad state of repair. Well, it's not anymore. So anytime I go to ANZAC Square, I think, well, yeah, I did that. The other thing I think was, because I was the Aboriginal Affairs Minister and the Minister for Multicultural Affairs, one day I went to the island of Mur, which is up in the Torres Strait, in the eastern end of the Torres Strait, because we were going through a process of handing land back to the traditional owners. Now, the island of Mur is where Eddie Mabo came from. So I went there and there was some big celebrations and the minister hops off the plane, that was me, there were all the dancing and the songs and the celebrations. And as I signed the document, the transfer of the land and that island went from the Queensland Government in trust to the islanders. It was a really special moment. And Eddie Mabo's kids, son and daughter, was there, and they took me up to his gravesite. And I've got a very special photo at Eddie Mabo's gravesite on Mur. So there was a lot of that. We handed back hundreds of thousands of hectares to the local indigenous population on the mainland as well as in the Torres Strait. It was really good. The other thing was in the multicultural affairs situation, and I always said there in the morning I'd be dealing with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who'd been here for 60,000 years, and in the afternoon I'd be dealing with refugees who had been off the boat, 24 hours. So from the oldest Australians to the very newest ones. And these people, mainly these days, coming from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, North Africa, they're here. And I'm not talking about boat people necessarily. I'm just talking about people who are coming under in various ways, and we have a refugee intake that the country does. But all they're wanting to do is get on with their life. They're wanting to settle into a community. They're wanting to get a job so they can save some money because their wife or their kids are probably still back in the other country. And they want to be able to bring them to Australia and have a new life. Now, People can argue about whether that is a good thing or a bad thing in terms of how many refugees we might take or ever or whatever. But I always ever looked at it as a person, because I'd be talking to a person about their experience. And when you talk to a person about their dreams and their aspirations, you couldn't help but feel for them. Excuse me. So we did all sorts of deals around the place to get major companies to take on refugees as workers. Some of the areas that we were most successful in is up in Rocky and the meatworks and so forth. No Australian wants to be carving up beef cattle and so forth. But these guys went in there and they were some of the most loyal workers that the meatworks had, because they were committed to the job to get the money to be able to do something for their family.
Considering your passion and hearing you speak about your life in public, as you know, as a politician, would you go back? Is there local government politics that you'd love to get you involved in? Or
federal's out of the question. In terms of state, you can't go back and do the state again. But look, I've had any number of people talk to me about the council election, because it's due in March 2020. And I'm just going to see how that stacks up. I mean, there are some things around the town that do need to be fixed. I think in some ways Noosa is becoming, I'm trying to think of the right word, but I think Noosa is becoming more insular. People are wanting more and wanting to give less. You know, we have a community that we have a so-called population cap on. So don't let any more people come into Noosa. It's this little enclave. But then at the same time, the people that live here want all of these government services, whether they're state services or federal services. Well, we were talking before about the financial hardship that the state has. Well, when those scarce resources come along and they're able to fund them, they're going to put it into a place that isn't growing, or they're going to put it into a place that's like North Lakes or wherever that is sort of going gangbusters. Caloundra South, there's 50,000 people going to Caloundra South, almost the population of the Noosa Shire. So that's where those facilities are going to go. They're not going to come here.
How do you reconcile those two? I think it was Noel Playford after his first kind of period in the new de-amalgamated Noosa Council had delivered his first budget, and he was spruiking the fact, I think it was along the lines where he said, look, it's great, we don't have to increase rates because there's been no growth. And back to this kind of this perception of this kind of enclave and very insular, they're probably not the words that a small growing business in the Noosa area want to hear.
But it's a fact.
So can I get more on that from you though, Glenn? Because as a small businessman or a businesswoman, you want to know that you're part of a community that's growing and thriving, and people are coming to spend there's an injection into the economy. So what's your take on that?
Overwhelmingly, when you talk to people, and they might have come here in the 70s, they came here in the 70s, they settled down.
Now we're full up, no more, thank you.
I don't want it to change.
That's right.
And the people who moved here yesterday look around the place, because they've been coming here on holidays for all those years and visiting and all the rest of it. I'm here now. I don't want it to change.
Close the gates.
Close the gates. Now, the point is, you might be able to close the gates in terms of the number of new houses that are built and so forth, and that, because if you're not doing that, that then leads to all sorts of other social problems in terms of affordable housing and so forth. But the thing that you can't stop is people who are going to drive into Noosa, use the facilities of Noosa, whether they're day trippers or, you know, people who live in the Sunshine Coast Council area, that puts all sorts of strain on the infrastructure that the Noosa Council has to put together. And that's something else that you hear people now sort of having a bit of a beef around.
Is it down Perigean Way with Perigean Village and Perigean Breeze?
Absolutely. You know, the amount of traffic on roads and lack of decent public transport.
So what's the solution to that?
Well, it's a mindset that the community has to have. Now, I understand why a population cap, so-called, was put in place, because the council had a good look around and thought, okay, we've got this road infrastructure, so how many cars can the roads take? I think one of the best examples was water. We have Lake McDonald as a primary source of water, but we also have an allocation from the Mary River. So how many people can we allow to or have drinking water from the water allocation that we have? And they did those exercises. Now, you've got to agree with the fact that you don't want something to keep on growing and growing and growing, and you can't turn the tap on and get any water out of it. So I can understand those sorts of things. And people put a lot of work into it. But the world doesn't stand still. Southeast Queensland particularly is not standing still. Now, we've got to keep our values. No one wants to see high rise, no one wants to see traffic lights and all that rest. So I understand that, and that's they're very important values that we need to keep. But we can't shut the rest of the world out, and we've got to find ways that allow us as a community to be able to treat with the rest of the coast and the people that want to come and visit and holiday here and all that sort of thing, as well as keeping our values in terms of the sort of lifestyle that we want to have as locals. Balancing.
Yeah. When it became apparent during the last state election that you didn't have the numbers and you weren't going to win, did you already have a plan B? Did you know what you were going to do next?
I'd started thinking about a plan B. We were talking about goals before.
Yeah.
You've got to start putting your mind not to, oh, God, I'm about to lose the election and that's the end of life as we know it, to, well, what am I going to start to do on the Monday? So I, in a funny sort of way, started putting my mind to that, and I've sort of sharpened it up, obviously, as time's gone on.
What are you doing?
Well, I formed a little consultancy company, Strategic Pathways Consulting, which meant forming a company and doing all those sorts of things, which was something I'd never done before, but then that's one of life's little pleasures. I'm involved in all sorts of things, electric buses, autonomous electric buses in particular.
Is that like driverless?
Driverless buses, and they're being trialled now in different parts of the company, country rather. So I'm looking at what we might do there. There's a new system or new way of paying your rates, a little company called Snip, that allows you to pay your rates on your mobile phone. So I'm talking to one council at the moment who look like taking that on, and that's been my experiment with that. So having got that across the line, I'll be able to roll it out into other local authority areas. Mental health for young people. There's a place being built at Turinga in Brisbane, but they'll do a lot of outreach into country Queensland. So again, that's that sort of the bush part of my existence, which is just so terribly important because people living in remote communities don't have the same access to health and healthcare and so forth. But a lot of that be able to be done by video conferencing and so forth. So it's, you know, it's that new technology that's around the place. So there's whole range of things. Someone comes up and goes, look, Glenn, I need some advice on this. What do I know about that? Nothing. So you sort of go off and you learn and you talk to people. So it's certainly keeping the brain from going to mush, I can tell you.
Right. Glenn Elms, I really appreciate you coming in and having a chat about your political career and your radio career and all that. It was great.
Good on you. Thank you.
Glenn Elms there. He was my guest today on Conversations in Noosa. If you enjoyed that podcast, please feel free to rate and review Conversations in Noosa and share the podcast with family and friends on your social media channels. There are two fresh podcasts every week up on our In Noosa Magazine website, innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations. Until next time.